Naturally speaking.
All right, welcome to another episode of Naturally Speaking. Today we've got a couple of the new, relatively new members of our faculty here in the department, the University of Glasgow. Before we get into that, I'm here with James. Well, I'm Sean Killen.
And I'm James Grecian.
James Grecian here with me, as usual. But who do we have with us here today? We have Jason Mathiopoulos, who comes to us from the University of St. Andrews. And how long have you been with us now?
4 months.
4 months now. How are you looking at so far?
Fantastic. Yeah. Better than I expected.
Oh, well, that's good. Better than worse than you expected. And Grant Hopcraft, who you've been here for a few years now.
Yeah, for a few years, but really just started working with Glasgow in November. So, well, actually, I was at St. Andrews for a short stint as well. And then before that was in University of Groningen in Holland.
Okay. So I guess what you guys have in common, really, is that you're both spatial ecologists. This is sort of a spatial ecology-themed episode here. So I have a challenge for you guys. A lot of people might not exactly know what spatial ecology is. So define it for us without using the words spatial or ecology. Go.
Okay, well,
maybe take as long as you need. Right, we can edit out the awkward pauses.
Well, I would say that it's looking at distribution of events or, and in particular, we're interested in animals or organisms, and how those patterns are falling across landscapes, and the interaction between those patterns, between different types of organisms, and between those patterns themselves.
Would you agree with that, Jason?
Yeah. No, definitely would agree with that. I would also say that from a more conceptual perspective, spatial ecology is the area which examines what are the implications of short-term decisions, both foraging or any other behavioral decisions that animals make, but also dispersal attributes that plants might have on the sort of long-term and large scale. And it becomes really, really interesting when it starts to deviate, when real biology starts to deviate from the assumption of perfect mixing and the assumption where everybody is just as likely to interact with everybody else. So from a theoretical perspective, it's really interesting to examine what happens to sort of classic models of population dynamics when you introduce this heterogeneity in the interactions between individuals.
And so you can look at different scales as well, sort of regional or local scales, or
and actually
right up to the global scale, looking at landscape patterns and how that affects.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I find with sort of spatial ecology is that quite often the patterns you observe in small scales don't necessarily scale up in the way that you would anticipate them. So they're not necessarily kind of like the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you end up with these weird things like Jason's talking about, where suddenly you end up with very strange population dynamics simply because animals are choosing to associate with each other in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. That's almost an interesting parallel with what you get with individual animals as well, with body size issues, where behaviors or processes that happen in small animals don't happen the same way in large animals.
Yeah,
that's actually,
right.
I think, a nice link for talking about some of your work, Grant, because some of your previous work has looked at how large and small animals and their physiological processes, how they differ moving from a small ruminant to a large ruminant, how that affects the way they interact over a landscape, right? You want to talk a little bit about some of your previous work in that area?
Sure. I guess one of the central questions is how can it be that you can have some ecosystems with, 28 species of herbivores all eating the same thing, right? Mm-hmm.
And this you're talking about in Africa.
I'm talking about, exactly.
Serengeti.
So, we're talking about the Serengeti ecosystem. This is an ecosystem that's very diverse in terms of like ungulate community and the herbivore community, but also in the predator community. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that really intrigued us is that how is it possible that you can have so many species all in the same, all using the same resource, right?
When we talk about this ecosystem, how big is the Serengeti? Just we were talking about things scaling from kind of small scale to large scale, like the Serengeti top to bottom, for example.
Okay, so top to bottom, it's about 260 kilometers.
Okay.
And east to west, it's about 180. So the whole thing comes to about 25,000 square kilometers, but it's not all within like protected areas.
Right.
It's kind of diffuse. I mean, how do you define an ecosystem, right?
Yeah,
there's no boundary.
Yeah,
there's thousands of animals kicking about doing that thing.
Yeah, exactly. So the question was, I mean, how do all these animals sort of coexist? And one of the interesting things about being a herbivore is actually it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because you got to break down cellulose, and that's an incredibly hard thing to do.
Yeah. And avoid predators.
Right. And really, in order to break down those things, you kind of need a fairly complicated physiology, gut physiology.
Mm-hmm.
And that depends on having, well, in the ruminant case, four stomachs, you know, these, you know, the four stomachs, or in the equids, you have this hindgut fermentation and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So we started looking at how the gut physiology might determine what an animal could eat. But also the other interesting thing is that the smaller you get, the more susceptible you become, like you said, Sean, mm-hmm. to lots of predators.
But also, I never really thought about this before, but smaller animals have a tougher time digesting their food if they're a herbivore.
Yeah,
if they're
right.
ruminant, right?
Yeah.
And that's because the food just doesn't stay in their gut as long.
Well, the thing is, in order to get enough energy out of like things like grass and cellulose, you need mm-hmm. to ferment it for quite a long time. And in order to do that, you actually need quite a big space in order if you're gonna get enough quality out of it. Whereas if you're the size of like a small dog, like a Thompson gazelle is only 20 kilos, right? You simply don't have the space. So the only way that you can get enough energy out is by eating the highest qualities.
And when I read that, I was thinking to myself, like, these small ruminants are really kind of snobs. They only eat the finest quality grasses.
Oh yeah, they're
because the food quality is what limits them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas you're talking about this paper that was in Journal of Animal Ecology in 2011 that we're basing most of this conversation on. And you were also talking about, so the smaller ruminants are limited by food quality, and it's the larger ones that are more limited by abundance.
Yeah, right, by abundance, and in fact, they become very very unconstrained. So the smaller, they're essentially like the poodles. I mean, if you're going to think of this like in terms of like dogs across Glasgow, they're the little guys, all the little Thompson gazelle and the herbivores. They're the dainty poodles of the Serengeti, right? And then you've got like the big sort of big buffalo and stuff that, you know, can essentially survive on anything.
Well, it's pretty convenient too that being large sort of leaves you unconstrained in the types of food you can eat. You can basically eat anything, but it also protects you from predators to some extent. So if you're a huge elephant, you can kind of go anywhere.
Right.
What you need to do, basically, because you're only constrained by how much food you can get.
Right.
So you're just kind of...
Exactly. So in order to get enough food, you just have to wander far and wide.
Yeah.
To get enough, right.
So you basically, for this paper, and I guess a lot of your work involves, you know, going down to the Serengeti, surveying areas.
Yeah.
And so in this paper, you're surveying landscape features, all kinds of different characteristics like food quality or grass quality and abundance.
Yeah.
Moisture.
Yeah, that's right. Different thicknesses of the vegetation aspects and things like that. So it's kind of, and of course, then on top of that, we have to get like abundances of animals. In other words, where are these animals actually occupying? And these are issues that Jason was addressing in his paper as well, right? And I mean, that's a bit of a problem in itself. So essentially what we were trying to do is combine sort of metrics of, like you said, grass quality. So you have a whole bunch of grass vegetation sites that you go out and clip grasses on, measure the nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking for the thickness of and different types of species of trees and stuff like that might be associated with, you know, cover.
Yeah.
Distances to rivers, all this sort of stuff. And then you overlay that with essentially where these animals are found, getting back to our sort of spatial ecology.
And how do you quantify where the animals are? Are you out in trucks driving around saying, there's a wildebeest,
there's a buffalo, the wildebeest. Hallelujah.
Or are you doing aerial surveys or tracking data, or how do you quantify species?
So we do a bit of both, but for this paper, we based it mainly on aerial surveys because it's the best sort of synopsis across the entire ecosystem. You can imagine if you're trying to count animals across 25,000 square kilometers from a vehicle, you're probably not going to get very far, mm-hmm. right? So essentially what's done is there's transects that we fly, and you're looking out the side of the aircraft on a strip, and you count the number of animals in that strip, and you quantify that.
So the strip is on the window of the airplane?
It's actually very high tech. We glue on some fishing rods onto the wing strut of the aircraft.
Okay.
And they're calibrated so that when you're sitting comfortably, you at a certain elevation, you're counting essentially 200 meters.
Okay. Straight. Wow.
Similar to how you do it for aerial surveys for birds at sea.
Yeah, right. Or seals and marine mammals and stuff like that. So it's
proving once again that gaffer tape or duct tape is the most important tool.
Behind every single good scientific
science. Right. Right behind cable plastic cable ties.
That's right, yeah. Interesting to see the proportion of tape in nature papers.
So that's pretty cool. So basically what you found then is that you found more or less what you expected, that when you surveyed the abundance of animals and looked at the habit or the landscape characteristics, you found that the smaller animals were sort of drawn to areas with
higher
food quality.
Exactly, yeah. Well, what we found, I mean, so this, first of all, this is taking a 21 years of survey data. So
yeah, they've been doing that was these amazing surveys. When I read that. Yeah.
They've been doing these surveys for an awfully long time. In fact, Tony Sinclair and people like that started it in like 1964, 65.
Focusing in on five particular herbivore species, well, so too large, too small, or in one.
No, in fact, the surveys do a lot more than that. So they count. They're trying to account essentially all the major herbivores, plus they're looking for impacts of human stuff, human impact. So they're looking for signs of illegal events, for instance, poaching events, but also. Agricultural areas, because the transects extend beyond the area, the protected area. Mm-hmm. So they're going out into community areas as well. So they're looking at sort of changes and things like that. So, but one of the things they're counting are these five species of herbivores. Mm-hmm. And essentially what we found was that, so you can imagine a buffalo, which is about 650 kilos, right?
Yeah.
That's a big animal. And then there's an animal called a topi and a congoni, which are both relatives of the wildebeest, at about 160 kilos. And then you're getting down into the smaller gazelles, Grant's gazelle and Thompson's gazelle.
How did you get a gazelle named after you?
Who's Thompson anyhow?
Sorry, derailed you.
But what's the detectability like for kind of a Tommy? I mean, if you're flying a plane at 100 kilometers an hour, a couple of hundred kilometers an hour, and it's like you're trying to pick out something that's 20 kilos and, 50 centimeters at the shoulder or something.
Yeah, you do have
you're
a detectability
problem.
You're never
going to be able to see things
problem.
Like dictics or anything.
Mm. No, that's right. Like. Yeah, dictics, in fact, we had to exclude. Those were out altogether.
I'm not going to make any jokes.
Yeah, the jokes are obvious. Yeah, why two?
Oh, Jason's wondering what the hell he's got himself involved with here.
So I guess when we talk about like space use and we talk about how animals are selecting for food or finding resource patches and having this kind of struggling for this trade-off between foraging for as much as they can, especially in the case of a small deer, when their gut isn't very large, so they can't ferment very quickly. They ferment very quickly, so they have to eat as much as they can, but then at the same time kind of mitigate for predation risk. We kind of got this trade-off between different traits, if you like, and it kind of... I'm desperately trying to lead this into something from Jason.
Well, actually, I'll tell you, I think one of the interesting segues is that some of the work that Jason does is looking at sort of the assumptions of that we're making when we're making these resource selection functions. And so my paper was based entirely on a resource selection function where we assume that the animals are what we would detect on that one count, 21 counts, one day at a time, is applicable to the entire ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's entirely likely, you know, that's kind of the data we have, but it's entirely likely that might not be.
So the concern then, if I'm understanding correctly, is that the days that you're sampling on, there might be something unusual about those days that are drawing the animals to particular parts of their habitat or that season or...
So we always sample in the same season, but the concern is that it's essentially... It's 21 years of data, we're calling it. But in truth, it's 21 days of data over 21 years.
Okay.
So in actual fact, your N is incredibly small, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And how do you get around that?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting...
So there's no within-year repeatability at all?
No.
So you only have one survey day per...
It's... the surveys actually take... 10 days.
Okay.
But you only do the
transect in one particular location.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's where you're work comes in.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the biggest realizations, I mean, just looking at other people's data, has been how, you know, the specificity of the inferences you draw from these analyses on these precise conditions.
How do you extrapolate under those
which you collected the data? So I'm not just talking about random variation. I'm talking about circumstances conspiring to make you draw conclusions that are not necessarily going to be the same if you change the circumstances under which you collect your data. So I'm mostly talking about statistical models or empirical models here, as opposed to the much more mechanistic flavor of models that a lot of people talk about, but very few people actually develop. So I'm not thinking in terms of models, individual based models, where people make simulations right from the nitty-gritty of energetics, behavior, all the way up to population dynamics. Sure. You know, we think about these models, but actually what most of us do is regression models. So we basically draw lines, or more complicated lines or curves, through clouds of data.
Yeah.
And, you know, what my stats lectures used to tell me is that correlation is not causation, and that was a sort of mantra that we were forced to memorize. Yet the vast majority of the literature looks at these correlations and tries to draw some biological inferences, because that's our job. That's what we're here to do.
So I guess one of the problems is that you track it in, you know, my experience anyway, you track an individual through a landscape, or you go out and you survey an individual through a landscape. And what you try and do is correlate the locations or something about that kind of space use, be it the speed or some kind of behavioral proxy. And then you look at the underlying habitat and you say, so when this animal's traveling slowly, is it because it's foraging? And so you then look at some kind of proxy for food, be it in Grant's case, you look at vegetation index, or in my case, you'd look at sea surface temperature or chlorophyll as some kind of underlying oceanographic productivity. And then what you do is you basically regress that, and you do a correlation, do some kind of model, and then you try and make predictions from it.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is the current kind of statistical frameworks that we use, be it just a general linear model or even a mixed model, their predictive power in space isn't very good.
I think, well, it's exactly as you describe it. So, I mean, it's an entirely legitimate question biologically to say that animals or plants are where they are because, or partly because, there's something there that attracts them or allows them to carry on existing at that location. So from an epistemological point of view, it's an entirely plausible, legitimate question to ask. The question is, how do you interpret the results of this model fitting? There's like any regression model, what you get are things that are estimates of the parameters involved in these models. So if you think about the intercept and the slope of a simple regression model, for example, what we do when we obtain this fitted value is to go to the slope and look first of all at whether it's positive or negative, and how big it is. So how sharply is this line going up or down? And we tend to interpret this as a avoidance of increasing values of that particular resource or condition, preference for it or indifference for it. And the sign of the slope and the magnitude of the slope, we attach a biological significance to. Now, there's two problems with that. The first problem is that the models that we need to fit in real ecological systems need to be multidimensional. We have several attributes that help the animals or the plants decide where they're going to be. And the second one is that any organism is subject to a unit sum constraint, which means they've got only about up to 100% of their time to devote to different activities. So these different attributes and these different types of habitats compete against each other for the organism's time. And therefore, in order to decide what the organism is going to do, where we're going to find it, we really need to take into account the entire profile of the environment, all these things that are competing for the organism's attention. And if we simply look at one particular scenario of what a population of, say, wildebeest do in a given configuration of conditions, we are not really protecting ourselves against that behavior changing completely if you change the profile of the environment. Mm-hmm. So I was really quite interested in Grant's paper because it does exactly that. It looks at the signs, the sort of directions, and the magnitudes of the slopes in response to different environmental covariates.
Right. Yeah.
But it also anticipates the this phenomenon called a functional response in environmental conditions. So there's one point where you say that animals might select a resource, but avoid areas where it is overabundant.
Right.
Now, yeah. Fundamentally, I can see no biological reason why that should be happening. But I can see how fitting a model to a particular set of data could mislead you into thinking that there is avoidance for a resource. So if I give you a very simple example, I absolutely need my bed. I need to be able to sleep for a certain amount of hours.
It's way too early in the morning.
Even though the 5-hour commute to Glasgow seriously curtailed my allocation. But my bed is an essential resource for me. So within the environment of my home, I need to have a bed somewhere in there. Now, if you place me in a house which had a tiny living room and 20 bedrooms, you would find me using those bedrooms very little compared to their overall availability. Mm-hmm. A statistical model fitted to these data would lead you to conclude that I have an avoidance towards beds.
yeah, right.
Even though biologically it's an absolutely essential resource for me for a set amount of time. So this is the sort of biological process that can mislead these empirical models. Mm-hmm. And in that paper that we're so discussing, I've got on the table here, this was the problem that we were trying to deal with.
So somehow you have to take into account the abundance or the density of whatever characteristic of the landscape or habitat that you're using.
Correct. Yeah. So what we've done in this paper in one phrase is we've written every single slope parameter in the model as a function itself of the entire environmental profile that the animals find themselves in. And this has allowed us to calculate parameters about that parameter, which describe how that parameter, how the response to a particular resource changes as a function of the whole makeup of the environment. So that allows us to try and predict what the organisms will do in as yet unobserved environmental profiles.
I think it's actually a really interesting and a clever sort of approach, I think, because one of the things, like you're right, is it comes up all the time in conservation biology when you're looking at we're trying to reintroduce a species. What are the habitats that it uses, and we need to recreate those habitats. But those habitats aren't necessarily what you're finding at one scale. Is coming back to the beginning, what you're finding at one scale isn't necessarily applicable across the entire thing. So, these reintroduction with frogs, for instance, this is a prime example. You know, you're taking the major habitat types, recreating them, letting the frogs go, and discovering the population actually doesn't do that well because you're missing out, one critical aspect.
Especially if you've got a species that's being pushed to kind of edge habitat and it's not in its kind of natural niche through competition or extinction risk or something like that.
Yeah.
You then try and recreate more marginal habitat for it, and of course it's never going to do well.
Exactly. So all you're doing is recreating more marginal habitat, which is not.
That's another problem with these potential problem with these models is that the absolute population size, whose distribution you observe, stands to change the distribution that you observe. So, for example, if you have very, very few animals living in this great, huge environment, you would expect them, assuming they're quite efficient in searching, you would expect them to gravitate towards a local or global peak in habitat suitability. Mm. Whereas when you're starting to crowd that environment, you would expect homogeneity in distribution to start creeping in as these
disperse.
Yeah.
When there's more of them.
So in the first case, you might find a much sharper signal in terms of preference compared to the second case. So the absolute population size can change your inferences about habitat preference, which is another problem that we need to start tackling before too long.
You're talking about sort of introducing a new way of looking at some of these problems, or is this these types of models you're talking about just aren't as commonly used then as more simple.
There's no models really that account for these changes. Okay. So the vast majority of papers that look at habitat preference, there's a lot of them as well, take a snapshot of data, because that's really what we can get in most cases. Fit a statistical model to those and directly interpret the parameters of this model in a biological way.
Mm-hmm.
So there is causation in there, but it's not certain that the parameter values that you get are directly related to it and always true to what they represent. So to give you an example, a slope coefficient of zero usually is subjected to some form of statistical testing, hypothesis testing. And a slope coefficient that's close enough to zero is usually interpreted to mean that this particular variable has no effect on the system that you're observing. When in fact, in these models, it could mean that it's provided to the organisms in exactly the perfect amounts. So they have no apparent preference, i.e. they're not missing it, so they're searching it out, and they have no apparent avoidance, so it's not offered in superabundance, so that we get this apparent avoidance. So, you know, this is a completely different interpretation of these models that we need to start to allow for.
No, that's really cool. I think it's cool how your guys' work sort of overlaps. Well, not overlaps, it's very complementary.
It is.
It is, yeah.
And the types of data that you collect and the ways that Jason looks at it.
Right, yeah, exactly.
We're also interested in sort of a common interest in the emergence of migration, which is not something that these papers tackle directly.
Yeah. And so that's going to be, Grant, your next major project is looking at migration patterns again in Africa, but with wildebeest and zebra.
That's right, yeah.
I guess we'll just quickly kind of wrap up with talking a little bit about that, if you just want to quickly sum up what you'll be doing over the next few years.
So what we have, what we're going to be working on in the next few years is trying to look at variation in routes and migratory routes, and trying to become a little bit more predictable in how in understanding how these animals are actually moving.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we're putting on radio collars onto zebra and wildebeest, and these are two species that are migrating around the same ecosystem, both in Serengeti, and very similar migratory routes, but from a completely different taxonomic background, right? You've got a ruminant and an equid.
So wildebeest and zebras.
And wildebeest and the zebra, yeah. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at how these animals are moving and their trajectories, and relate that to sort of the landscape features that they're moving through. But the exciting thing about it, I think, which is, as far as I'm aware, maybe Jason knows better, is that I don't think it's been done before, is to be able to recreate physiological conditions of those animals as they're moving through these environments. And the way we're doing that is we're pulling tail hair, and by sequencing the tail hair into small little splices, you can get and looking for the steroid hormones, you can get a profile of
how their physiology is varied throughout their migration.
Right, throughout the migration. So now you have information about where they've moved, how they've moved, the landscapes they're moving through, and what they were kind of feeling in a loose term as they're moving through.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this feeling aspect, unbelievably, is what the modeling is going to focus on. We've got a joint proposal for a PhD, which is going to try and guess what the hidden behavioral processes are that give rise to the migratory patterns that we observe in Grant's animals, but also in other processes like cancer cells and aggregations of organisms with hopefully basic behavioral rules interacting with each other and giving rise to migratory patterns of a particular form.
So some pretty far-reaching implications. I get the feeling we could sit here and talk about this all day. There's actually a lot of things I'd like to talk to you about my own interest, but I think we should probably start wrapping things up here. Just to finish things off, I actually took the liberty of getting a couple jokes off the internet. I tried to find some general linear model jokes, but I unfortunately don't have any of those, Jason, sorry. But I found some wildebeest and zebra jokes for you, Grant. There's actually a website called zebrahumor.com.
Really?
That's hilarious.
Did you bookmark it?
No, I'll send it to you. Well, you can look it up. There you go. So what's black and white, black and white, black and white, and green?
Don't know.
Three zebras eating a pickle. And finally, what do you call a confused wildebeest?
It's got to be a zebra.
A bewildered beast.
A bewildered beast.
And with that...
For more jokes like that, tune in next time. You've been listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast.
Thanks for listening again, and we'll talk to you later. Do we have like a sign-off that we normally do? I can't remember.
It's a really lame kind of, bye.
Bye. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.